I want to thank the organizers of this conference for putting together such an amazing program and giving me the chance to spend 2 days with the people who are doing some of the most interesting thinking in this very exciting field of law and the emotions. In my paper for today, I take as the subject of inquiry the organizing assumption of this conference. Despite the fact that law and emotions research has begun to flourish both inside the law and out, and despite the fact that family law seems positively rife with emotion, the role of emotion in family law has been under-investigated. It's actually lagged behind work, say, in criminal law, another area where emotion is very much on the surface of the human interactions at stake and is sometimes an explicit focus of doctrine. My talk today aims to examine and explain this gap by looking at resistance to law and emotions work in general and resistance to such work in the area of family law in particular. I then try to sketch an agenda for research that's designed to address this gap. But why, you might ask, do I want to address the comparative neglect of emotion in family law at this point? After all, you could say this conference is proof positive of the fact that scholars in law, as well as in the behavioral and social and biological sciences, are beginning to think about the role of emotion in family and how it might be addressed through law. So why think about impediments now? My answer is this. I believe that despite these promising developments, the kinds of barriers I'm going to describe for you today are likely to continue to shape our investigation, limiting us in the emotions that we're likely to apprehend and explore, and more importantly, impeding the use of law as an instrumentality to engage them. So I see the kind of inquiry I'm undertaking today and the kind of research it recommends as a necessary adjunct to the particular examples of scholarship on family law that your family law and the emotions that you're going to hear throughout the rest of the conference. To better understand the sources of resistance to law and the emotion scholarship, I'd like to start by describing the way this inquiry has unfolded, specifically in the field of legal scholarship. In a recent paper, Professor Hila Karen and I argue that law and emotions work, as it's being done within the field of law, has had three different currents or dimensions. These currents emerged in a particular chronological order, but it's fair to say they're now operating contemporaneously, sometimes even within the frame of a particular piece of work. I'll describe them here with a set of alliterative labels: recognition, reconnaissance, and regulation. The recognition current was the first out of the gate. This body of work argued that emotion played an often unacknowledged but salient role both in those transactions governed by law and, more controversially, in legal decision-making itself. This work goes back to the late 1980s and reflects the contributions of feminist legal scholarship in challenging legal objectivity and exploring the affective dimensions of human and legal thought. It was given a crucial boost by sitting jurists such as William Brennan and Wisconsin State Supreme Court Justice Shirley Abrahamson, who wrote or talked about the role that emotion had played in their own decision-making. Now, the citadel of legal rationality, I want to assure you, was not completely surrendered. But these initial rounds prompted some recognition that emotion was germane to the functioning of law. So a number of scholars proceeded to the next current, which I'll call reconnaissance. In this current, scholars ventured out from law into fields where emotions had a much longer history of empirical and theoretical investigation. These included fields like philosophy, psychology, literature, social norm theory, and neuroscience. Legal scholars drew from these fields understandings that could inform the law's engagement with particular emotions. Professor Huntington's investigation of the cycle of love, hate, guilt, and repair in the work of Melanie Klein, or Professor Maldonado's work on forgiveness, have this dimension as well as other dimensions. This work has often been emotion-focused. It highlighted a particular emotion such as fear or disgust and asked how it had been analyzed in a particular discipline or set of disciplines. And in the early stages of this work, this research was often oriented toward the negative emotions, perhaps because emotions such as fear, vengeance, or remorse played a visible and long-standing role in the enforcement of the criminal law. The third current, which I'm going to call here by the term regulation, is still in its early stages. In this work, legal scholars turn to the task of normative prescription, which we're going to hear more from Professor Huntington about later. They ask what particular insights regarding emotion mean for the way we decide cases, structure legal rules, or create institutions through the use of law. I use the term regulation to signal that normative moves in this work have a more specific character. Work in the second current was sometimes addressed to very broad normative questions, such as, should disgust play a role in criminal law? In the more recent work, the question isn't so much should or shouldn't a particular emotion be recognized through law, but how, when, and perhaps most importantly, through what kinds of legal interventions should we do so? Now, when resistance has emerged to these forms of law and emotion scholarship, it's followed a fairly consistent pattern. It occurs primarily in relation to the first current, recognition, or the third current, regulation. There can certainly be objections to reconnaissance scholarship. Does a legal scholar have sufficiently deep understanding of the cognate discipline on which he draws? Does one non-legal discipline provide better insight into the character of a particular emotion than another? But where most of the contestation has occurred is with respect to recognition and, more recently, regulation. With respect to recognition, critics sometimes argued that the particular transactions governed by law were not characterized by strong affective dimensions. Contracts, for example, were impersonal, arm's-length transactions. So looking at emotion in these domains was analyzing something extrinsic and not integral to the activity. But more centrally, objections to this phase of scholarship argued that legal decision-making was a realm that derived its character, or at least its legitimacy, from its objectivity, meaning not just its neutrality in the sense of impartiality, but its disengagement from powerful political forces and from particulars such as the lives of the parties before a court. These reassuring forms of distance, disengagement, and universality were threatened by the unruliness and the particularity of emotion. A second set of objections have addressed law and emotion scholarship in the regulatory vein. These newer objections concern the appropriateness of law in general as a tool for engaging the emotions. One critique focuses on the inappropriateness of legal intervention. Legal intrusion on the emotions comes perilously close to mind control, implicating a core element of our humanity that we don't want to surrender to government or to law. Another critique, sort of the mirror image, claims that legal intervention will not change feeling states, but will produce inauthentic manifestations of emotion served up for legal delectation, such as we sometimes see when courts demand that defendants show remorse during criminal sentencing. As I began to think about the family law area, however, I made what seemed to me to be an interesting discovery. The barriers to the analysis of emotion in this area, the family law area, seemed to me different than in other areas of law. They weren't grounded simply in a stubborn insistence on law's objectivity or a concern about using law to intrude on one of the most intimate precincts of the human personality. Resistance, or to put it in a less intentional frame, barriers to the analysis of emotion in this area stem from the family's relation to an ideologically charged and still gendered boundary, the public-private divide. They also arise from the doctrinal boundaries that structure the way we address family life through law. We can see this by comparing family law to criminal law, an area which, as I mentioned earlier, we've seen law and emotion scholarship flourishing for almost a decade. The differences between family law and criminal law crack the distinction between public or private, or in the terms of feminist legal theory, the separate spheres that constituted that famous 19th century ideology. While you might think that this difference would make it easier to recognize emotion in the domain of family law, it hasn't often worked out that way. For starters, family law scholars have probably been deterred from exploring the emotions by the possibility that it would exacerbate what they see as the stigmatization of an already gendered field. Those who work in the comparatively virile world of criminal law, we're talking here about law enforcement on the one hand, or the defense of cold-blooded murderers, arsonists, and the like on the other, they may sense that they have enough masculine capital to venture into what may be perceived as a softer, affective, relational side of legal analysis. But when this analysis is undertaken by scholars already working in a highly gendered area, as my colleague Melissa Murray put it, and I should stress that she's a strong supporter of this work, well, we might as well be sitting around braiding each other's hair. The ostensibly private character of family life also makes it difficult to approach its emotions with the public discourse of law. The criminal law is a law of the public domain. Many crimes, particularly paradigmatic crimes like murder, robbery, or arson, occur in public. It's the state that vindicates public norms, and as many readily accept, expresses public emotions as it calls perpetrators to account. The emotions that are prominent within the criminal law, indignation, disgust, vengeance, remorse, or even the contested pseudo-emotion of closure, are emotions that we are accustomed to airing before others and that we have established forms of discourse for discussing in public settings. Family law, in contrast, is the law that is most particular to the private domain. Its feeling states, like its distinctive relations and practices, have tended to be shielded from public view, both by the fact that we lead family lives behind the closed doors of our home, and by the privacy that law accords to intact families. Some of the feelings that infuse family life, feelings such as jealousy, despair, or many of the emotions associated with sexuality, elevation, loss, guilt, fear, are associated with intimacy and even with shame, which makes their public iteration and the idea of engaging them through law particularly difficult. So there may be difficulty seeing and acknowledging the emotions that infuse family life, but perhaps more crucially, when we see them, we may find it awkward or counterintuitive to pair them with forms of public discourse that are connected with legal analysis. In addition, the family, for all the advances of gender equality, remains imbued with certain qualities that the ideology of the separate spheres once ascribed to the realm of domesticity. Now, by this I mean not that families have the roles or configurations that led 19th century commentators to wax eloquent about the angel of the house. By this I mean that traditional ideas about families, and particularly intact families, die hard, or at least leave traces. This is particularly true when we think about the emotions that infuse family life. The sphere of the family is still in some ways gendered feminine. As a matter of belief or commitment, if not always as a matter of empirical description, the family is still infused with the qualities of love, care, and concern that we've historically ascribed to women, regardless of who's doing the actual family labor. Consequently, our understanding of the affective content of that domain, the emotions that we're likely to find there, is likely to be gendered feminine as well. This has important implications for the recognition of emotion in the family law area. It means that when we're able to see emotions within the domestic realm, we are likely to see emotions that coincide with domestic notions of feminine nurturance. As Claire Huntington has argued, this has meant that we're more likely to see love than hate, as a matter of course. We're also less likely to focus on anger, because as my colleague Rachel Moran has argued, anger isn't associated with women. She describes it as the one emotion we don't expect women to manifest, or perhaps even experience. To extend this logic, there are a whole range of emotions that pervade family life that we're less likely to see because of the instinctive gendering of the domestic sphere. Not just anger, but vengeance, resentment, jealousy, not only of extramarital liaisons, but of one's spouse's leisure or of one's children's flourishing. Loneliness, desire, definitely not something we're acculturated to see readily in women. The dichotomous kinds of thinking that are characteristic of the public-private divide or the separate spheres ideology may also inhibit awareness of emotional patterns that are more complex or change over time. So we might recognize love in functional or intact families, hate in dysfunctional or non-intact families, but not the love, hate, guilt repair cycle Claire Huntington has written about, or other multifaceted dynamics that psychology, sociology, and mind science tell us are also important. Our ability to recognize the range of emotions that infuse family life is also impeded by a second kind of boundary, the arbitrary way that legal doctrine relating to the family has been structured. Let's think here about a trio of emotions, despair, fear, and humiliation. These emotions are everyday occurrences in the lives of many families, as the psychological literature makes clear, but we don't necessarily see them that way when we look at family law. If you think about lives lived in fear, you might think about spousal or child abuse. While these patterns can be and are grounds for divorce as a doctrinal matter, we tend to confront such families more frequently in criminal law or child welfare law. Another face of familial fear is those families for whom every knock at the door might mean immediate deportation and the separation of parents from children. But that would be immigration law rather than family law. If you think about despair, you might think of a 15-year-old who gives birth silently in a bathroom and disposes of the newborn in a dumpster. But that would be the criminal law of infanticide. Or the mother who finds herself increasingly unable to feed her children on food stamps or her minimum wage job. But that would be welfare law. A new generation of family law scholars, led by people like Carrie Abrams and Melissa Murray, is beginning to challenge the boundaries of family law and explore its deep interpenetration with other doctrinal areas. But existing artificial separations between the particular doctrinal areas that touch family life, the fact that they're litigated by different lawyers and investigated by different groups of scholars, produce several kinds of problems. First, family law scholars, or more general legal audiences, may conclude that emotions such as fear, despair, or humiliation are the province of particular kinds of families, those comprehended by immigration or welfare or criminal law. This may lead to a neglect of such emotions based on what sociologists have referred to as the socio-political economy of emotion. Most of us don't attend equally to the affective states of all groups. It's one dimension of socioeconomic privilege that one's affective states become a matter of broad public concern. Moreover, people who are privileged may expect the lives of the poor or the undocumented or those who commit crimes to entail fewer positive emotions and more negative emotions than their own. So when emotions like fear and despair appear most prominently in the lives of groups such as criminal offenders or those who are poor or undocumented, the doctrinal separation of these areas from family law exacerbates an existing tendency to neglect these emotions. It may also lead legal scholars to pathologize these emotions or fail to recognize their role in many different kinds of families. Fear may most distinctively be the province of the woman experience intimate violence or the undocumented immigrant. But this emotion is also present for the middle-class wife whose husband has left her for another woman. She now has to navigate life without a partner and perhaps return to the workplace she left 20 years ago on the birth of her first child. When we don't see this manifestation as well, we miss the opportunity to reflect on what the juxtaposition of these different areas reveals about the emotion itself. Yet recognition is not the only or even the most important area where we're likely to encounter barriers. Whether those legal scholars who are now beginning to recognize the role of emotion in family law will be able to formulate and implement normative proposals depends on a second category of resistance or barriers. Resistance to the regulation of emotion in the family. The familiar notion that emotion is an integral facet of human personality, which must be preserved from interference by law, also affects the domain of family law. But family law's location on the domesticized side of the public-private divide has produced some iterations of this resistance that are distinct to this area. I want to mention one that is specific to the positive emotions and one that applies more broadly to a range of emotions, including negative emotions. The first is a remnant of the 19th century conception of the family, the sense that the positive emotions, particularly those most strongly gendered feminine, such as love, risk being sullied by the intervention of the law. Like the natural and proper timidity of the female sex that the Bradwell Court found to be imperiled by the occupations of civil life, some legal scholars and jurists say that love risks being contaminated by its association with the market or the law. One of the most interesting controversies in the family law literature is the debate over the commodification of women's labor in the home. Efforts to value women's family labor in the division of property on divorce have met with a surprising amount of resistance among legal decision makers, including women, and among some feminists. Part of this resistance involves the suspicion of the imperialistic tendencies of economics, which often seem to crowd out other forms of valuation. But part of this suspicion arises simply from the prospect of involving the law in the almost sacralized emotion of familial love. Family law scholars are familiar with Borelli versus Brousseau, in which an elderly husband agreed to provide his younger wife with a substantial amount of money and property in exchange for her agreement to care for him at home rather than placing him in a care facility as he aged and became infirm. The court, when the children prevented this agreement from being enforced, the court declined to find an enforceable agreement. They said she was simply doing what wives are obliged by their affective and marital bonds to do for their husbands. But the court also reflected anxiety about the cold, rational hand of the law becoming involved in expressions of intimate commitment between spouses. This debate reflects a lot of resistance to what Professor Peggy Radin has described as hybridity, the notion that affective responses can be valued and also subject to legal intervention, venerated as authentic and priceless, but also commodified or given an economic value. This discomfort with hybrid treatment of positive familial emotions could predict a lot of resistance to programmatic intervention in family law. Concern that interventions designed to cultivate love or forgiveness might produce corrupted or inauthentic emotions. But if this first objection reflects an older notion of domesticity, a second objection arises from more contemporary developments. Recent cultural studies of the family suggest the emergence of a new account of domestic life that is different but seems likely to incite even more powerful resistance to legal intervention in the emotions of the family. In her new book, Sexual Citizens, Brenda Kossmann argues that over the past several decades, we've experienced a responsibilization of family roles. It is increasingly understood to be our responsibility as conforming individual citizens to see that these dimensions of our lives are closely and successfully managed. We are expected to make a systematically absorbing project out of our partnership or our marriage or our parenting, working constantly to make it as good as it can possibly be. In this effort, we are assisted by a range of self-help experts and pundits who deploy print and electronic media to offer guidance and enlist a virtual community to offer support and peer pressure for this endeavor. We are judged as citizens by the extent to which we succeed at this responsibilization. The state intervenes primarily on our failure to do so, an exceptional and stigmatizing moment that brands us as bad citizens. Now, if Kaufman is even partially correct about this emerging ideology of the family, her account has important implications for resistance to legal intervention in the emotions of the family. First, the new cultural regime that she describes means that the management of the emotions of family life has become private, not simply as a matter of right, but as a matter of responsibility. The cultural construction of family life makes state intervention, even in the support of family emotions, anomalous. It's like looking for governmental support for doing your homework or for keeping your children's clothes clean. While this responsibilization is undertaken by parents and spouses of both sexes, it seems particularly well suited to the dominant cultural image of the 21st century woman, professionally capable yet domestically attuned. Sarah Palin, that paragon of domestic responsibilization, doesn't need help managing even the unruliest emotions of her family. She's a good citizen, the capable private manager of her family's affective lives. That's why, as a mother, she can support the teen pregnancy of her daughter, but as governor, she can cut programs that support teen moms. This image and the emerging ideology suggest that the prospect of governmental intervention in the emotional lives of families may arouse not simply legal, but cultural or political resistance. But perhaps more to the point, this regime has configured the governmental role in a way that's dramatically opposed to what we might need if we were to contemplate a more systematic legal intervention in family emotions. As Kaufman makes quite clear, the law is not absent in this new regime. It plays a salient background role in the process of responsibilization. It promotes market relations, helping to reconstitute, as she says, individual subjects into market actors and citizen consumers. It preserves legal categories such as adultery, though they are rarely enforced, to create a backdrop for the self-regulation and cultural regulation of marital fidelity. Its most conspicuous role is the kind of harsh, stigmatizing, but notably infrequent discipline it imposes on those who fail to regulate themselves. Figures such as deadbeat dads or women who conceive children without the financial means to raise them. These intermittent, vehement efforts to incite the process of self-policing contrast sharply with the kind of ongoing ameliorative role we might envision for law in the support of family emotion. So if we take seriously the analysis of the field-specific barriers that I offer above, what kind of research agenda or strategy for scholarship might help to promote this ongoing work and to mitigate these impediments? First, I think we need to challenge the kinds of boundaries that have impeded the recognition of family-related emotions in legal work. This involves, first, attention to those often negative and distinctly non-feminine emotions which emerge in families but are neither anticipated nor authorized by the ideology of domesticity. It involves attention, second, to the way that these emotions emerge in a range of different families, those facing the threat of deportation or struggling with poverty or embroiled in the criminal justice system, as well as those leading at least temporarily middle-class lives in which the greatest threat may be marital breakdown. In both of these efforts, scholars working in the fields of psychology or related behavioral or mind sciences may be critical allies. The boundaries that I describe between love and hate, or between family law and immigration law, are features of our legal doctrinal regime relating to families and of the ideology that informs it. Although I would not be one to declare the value neutrality of science, they don't seem to function in exactly the same way in psychological and related research. It was the psychoanalytic theories of Melanie Klein, for example, that helped Professor Huntington to understand that we need to see not just love, but hate and guilt and repair in the lives of intact and divorcing families. And bodies of work such as Frank Fincham's investigation of forgiveness or Philip Shaver's research on attachment explore both the positive and negative manifestations of these emotion states. Unforgiveness and forgiveness, secure and insecure attachment. They help us see that in family law, as opposed to fields like criminal law, positive and negative emotions may not be as sharply separated. A focus on negative emotion at the level of recognition may be connected to an effort to ameliorate it or transform it into a positive emotion at the level of regulation or intervention. Collaboration with psychologists or other mind scientists might also help legal scholars to identify connections between families whose life circumstances tend to place them in different doctrinal worlds. What are the differences and similarities between the way fear manifests itself in families that include undocumented immigrants and in families encountering divorce? How are processes of attachment affected when a parent is sent to prison? And how is this similar to or different from the way attachment is affected by a parent's deportation, or for that matter, by a divorce? Research into the emergence and quality of emotions in different familial contexts may help us to move across the boundaries that doctrinal divisions create. Next, when it comes to the question of regulation or legal intervention in the emotions, there are at least two kinds of work to be done. The first is to clarify and elaborate the large range of legal interventions that might be entailed by a focus on family emotion. We need to see that the legal engagement of family emotions entails more than the kinds of interventions critics may fear most. Court orders that restructure the lives of families or other programmatic interventions made mandatory by law. In fact, the possibilities for legal intervention may be more varied and less intrusive in the area of family law than in a number of other legal fields. Interventions touching the emotions may often be indirect. They might include state statutes or local ordinances that affect the legal rights of battered women or the social or economic rights of undocumented immigrants. Even programmatic interventions that are aimed specifically at the emotions may not be particularly directive.